out there.
Ought to be a relativity and a radiation problem on there, I think.
Okay.
I don't know whether...
Like, find the skin depth, something like that.
Oh.
Like, plug these equations. I like that first assignment.
Yeah.
That's why I do that one.
Here's the wavelength. What's the frequency?
Well, please, that would be so nice. We really appreciate that. Like, a lot.
So that M dipole problem, that was from an old exam. So that.
What M dipole one? What was that?
Did I just say the one that was like five parts? No, you were
conservative. It's hard to come up with good radiation problems.
That's a good problem.
So you won't try.
But I already have those that are in the can, so I just have to pull them out. And they stump students in the past, so they must be good. What do I have to pay for that?
Absolutely nothing.
So I can still have lots of bad questions on the exam? It's a bribe?
No, it's
poison. You're allergic to
me. You haven't actually written the exam yet, right?
No reason to kill me if I have already done it. Thank you. This isn't like one of those brownies of fame, huh? Whoa! This isn't what made you the way you are, huh? Okay, questions?
The business of the last assignment where we're supposed to write down stuff that we got out of Mathematica and then verify that it equals.
Yes. So you're supposed to demonstrate these equations, right?
Shut both doors.
Oh, well, we should go over there when we take our tests and their class is laughing.
We can hear you clap. Yes, there they are. Mm-hmm.
Question.
What are these equations telling us?
Well, the same thing that the Mathematica is telling you.
Also, how do we relate the two? Because isn't that like a force tensor? These are electric and magnetic fields.
All true.
Okay.
So the components of that F mu nu are electric and magnetic fields. So, for example, B3 is the 1-2 component of that matrix. So what you want to do is to, in your problem, you've set the velocity equal to the x direction. So perpendicular, z would be an example of perpendicular. So the F1-2 component should be transforming like this, where, of course, we can relate the electric fields to the number four components. And it's really pretty easy if you write if you write your tensor in terms of those E's and B's. Because then you don't have to, so you're not going to be saying that F21 is equal to this, that, and the other thing. Mathematica should spit out that the thing that's in the 1-2 spot is this combination of E's and B's. So the only thing that should be slightly tricky about this, two things that should be slightly tricky about this. One is, at least the way I did it in the write-up, I didn't bother to put the C's in. I mean, just because it's easier.
C's, not CF.
Yes, yeah. So, and the other thing is you have to, you know, realize that if the velocity is, if U is in the X direction, what are you going to get from that cross product? More questions? They're not made up, so I don't know. Oh, those little ABC diagrams?
Yeah.
Boy. If I don't have one, I can. Because you can There's just no way you can reproduce one of those on the fly. Luckily, I've got one. So what's your question about it?
Well,
everything, huh?
Do we have a homework problem on this?
Yes.
Let's do that problem.
Luckily, I don't have a transparency of the homework problem, so I would be unable to do it. So,
two things like coming at each other like this.
So these are the usual S and S prime frames, except we've decided to view them in this kind of the center of mass frame, where they're going by each other, where both of them are moving at equal and opposite velocities past us.
So what's the time?
So these are digital clocks, and these are the times that they're reading off. So at this instant, according to S double prime, the center of mass frame, this clock is behind by 2 seconds, and this clock is ahead by 2 seconds. And that's what you get with lack of synchronization. When something is moving this away, the leading clock is behind. Same thing applies here. So this other one is moving this way, and notice that the leading clock is behind the trailing clock. The leading clocks are always behind the trailing clocks.
So is there like a delta T between frame A and frame B?
Yeah, so there are, it's the same time between all of these. And it's not 1 second. It's some, you know, square root of through two sort of time. And we don't need to know that, because that would have to do with times in this S double prime frame. And we're really just trying to do this to understand how people in the S and S prime frame can come to conclusions that are like this, where Jill is pointing at Jack and Jack is pointing at Jill, and they're both claiming that they're measuring the same thing. So we can do this for both Lorentz contraction and for time dilation. Let's try time dilation. So if we focus on this clock here, C, how long does it take according to the A prime, according to the primed observers, for this clock to click off 1 second? So at the instant when clock C reads 0, our clocks read 0, and when it reads 1, our clocks read 3.
If you're at the prime.
If we're in the prime coordinate system. So we say that your clocks are running a factor of 3 slow. For one click of your clock, 3 have actually gone over. Contrarywise, if somebody on the unprime frame decides to monitor, say, this A clock, currently it reads 2, how long does it take for it to click off 1 second? Well, when this one is reading 2, our clocks all read at the same instant, because our clocks are synchronized, even though they don't look synchronized. Our clocks all read minus 2 seconds. When this thing goes to 3, all our clocks read 1 second. Therefore, it takes 3 seconds in order for your clocks to click off 1 second.
We're in the ours changes 3 seconds, you're saying,
or
yours changes 1.
Yeah, so the S numbers changed from minus 2 to 1, while this clock changed from 2 to 3. They're just lined up, one clock after another.
Oh, I'm pretty like
say again?
Like the clock.
Oh, this thing here, those are just three different frames.
Okay.
And these are frames, of course, that are taken in this S double prime frame, the center of mass frame.
So three frames in the same scenario.
Yes, so these are just three frames as these two guys go by each other. And if we're careful, we can also look at length contraction. So if I, what's going to work? Well, let's see. So if I decide to measure where everything is at a time that is one in the S prime frame, what I see is that B is right next to B prime and E is right next to C prime at T prime equals one. So this entire section from from B to E, this whole section here, that's scrunched between B prime and C prime. Because at t prime equals 1, B is there, and at t prime equals 1, E is at C. So this whole section is scrunched between these two points at the instant t prime equals 1. So sure looks like this thing is Lorentz contracted by a factor of 3. Okay, so it's just a matter of thinking through these diagrams using the appropriate times and realizing that the reason these things don't seem synchronized in this picture is just because they're being taken from a third frame. If we see a moving sequence of clocks, the leading clock is going to seem like it's out of sync with the behind the trailing clock. Yeah, so it's two. There's only relative motion. So this guy could be the Earth, and this could be a spaceship, and we're in a spaceship that's just going at half that speed. So we see the Earth going this way, and the prime spaceship going that way. Or you know, we can have trains that are going this way, and we're the Earth. But there's only relative motion.
That's actually a picture.
Yeah. So I worry a little bit about this word picture because then you have to worry about time of flight for the light to reach the camera and things like this. But this is what you would actually measure if you were, you know, if you were trying to figure out what was going on at an instant in the S double prime frame. You would quote unquote see these facts. And if your camera is distant and perpendicular to the line of travel, the photograph would look like this. As long as we can make it so that the travel time of the light from here to here is the same, from here to our camera and from there to our camera is the same. So they're actually recording the same instant in the S double prime frame. Pictures would work the same way. More questions? Say again?
The whole scenario of putting your pole vault in your closet. It's actually not possible.
Yes, it is. Yes.
How do we know that this is possible?
Let's try it.
They measured the pole vault.
It did it once
and it worked. So let's rehearse the pole vault in the closet story. So I always start out with my closet having two doors on it, and people don't like that, but we can have.
What is that?
That's a closet. It's an outhouse with two doors on it.
I am not seeing the door at all.
This is these are open doors. They open up. They're like garage doors. Okay, so there's my shed, and here's my pole vault pole. So this is at rest. This is the view that we would see if we were at rest with either one of these objects. So I get my pole vault up to a very high speed, and of course it's just this big. So it has no trouble fitting inside this shed and me closing both doors at the same time. Well, it's moving at constant speed.
But you're going to squish it for an instant? Or only for a very small time period?
Well, yeah, it's moving. So if it's going to move out of this shed pretty quick.
What if it instantaneously stops?
Oh, so instantaneously stopping is not something I'm particularly in favor of. So it's physically impossible. Well,
what if it was just a little thing? Really little
the definition of instantaneous depends on your frame of reference. That's fundamentally the problem. But I think I'll answer your question later. Yeah. I think your real question is, what if I don't close these doors? What's going to happen? And how does that explain it? Okay, so this is what we would see. We would see this little tiny pole vault happily flying through the shed, and I could close the doors or not, and I would have the thing inside of it. So what's really confusing is to think about what this looks like to the pole vault. Right? So the pole vault, if you're riding along with the pole vault, it's still, you know, 10 meters long. What is true is that the shed has been really Lorentz contracted. So it seems like there's no hope that I can fit my pole vault into not a 1 meter shed, but into a fifth of a meter shed, because it's been contracted by so much. So what does it look like to the pole vault guy if I close the doors according to this guy? Well, exactly the sequence would be as follows. The pole vault, the big long pole vault, approaches the little tiny shed, and before it reaches the end, this door closes. And of course opens in time because of the way I'm doing it. Sometime later, the shed, it reaches the end, and then this door closes and it opens. Yeah, so what I'm doing is I'm closing these doors at the same time, according to me, so that I'm sure that the pole vault is inside the shed. And then I'm opening them again.
So, okay.
Because
so
I don't want to have a mess.
I'm looking at a shed and Alice has a pole vault. And she's like running in the pole vault, right? So she's riding the pole vault.
Yeah, if she's riding the pole vault, it's a pole vault, right? It has its rest length. But the shed is going by at high speed, so it's crunched down to some really tiny size. And what seems to the guy at rest in the shed of simultaneously closing the doors doesn't look anything like simultaneous to the person riding the pole vault. She sees this door close, and then way later, when the shed reaches the other side, then the other door closes. So of course the pole vault was never inside the shed, because you didn't close the doors at the same time. So this at the same time is the trick that gets you out of this game.
So that's why it's...
Yeah. Are we okay with that?
How okay do we need to be with it?
Perfectly okay with it.
I have a question regarding, like, so let's say you get this thing contracted to, like, the pole vault from the rest, if you're at the shed, the rest position. You get the pole vault contracted to, just so it fits inside the shed. But to shut the doors and actually trap the pole vault inside, you need to shut the doors and the other super light too. So would they become contracted? I mean, to get them shut while the thing's in there, because it's traveling the other super light.
Well, I don't think that's a fundamental problem. So for example, instead of having these things fly down, you can have them slide, and you can have them moving so that they're going to slide, you know, just a centimeter in order to cut off the pole vault. So I think the question quickly comes to be is, what happens if I don't close the doors?
Why?
Or excuse me, why don't, if I don't open the doors, if I just close them, then what's going to happen? And you know what's going to happen, if I don't close these doors, this little pole vault is going to run into this door, and it's going to end up as a mess, a shredded pole vault. And we better have that same conclusion, no matter what frame we're in. Okay, so in this picture, if you don't close the door, then the pole vault is going to run into this door. There's no stopping it. I'm not opening the door now. I'm closing it forever, and I'm reinforcing it so that it's not going to move. So isn't that going to stop this end of the pole vault before it gets inside the door? And the answer is no. It turns out that you can do the calculation. Things can't move faster than the speed of light. So if we take light the fastest possible impulse telling this thing to stop, and the speed that this thing was and the speed that the shed is moving at, it turns out that it's impossible to stop this end of the rod until the shed has reached the far end and has closed its door.
So it's not even like the pole's collapsing, it's something completely, I mean, I imagine it's just like there's enough momentum to carry it back and forward, and the pole is semi-rigid or whatever, but it's not even that, it's like not reacting.
So, I mean, what's going to happen, of course, is at some intermediate time, we're going to have the shed that has moved, and we're going to have lots of crumpled pole vault rod, and this rod hasn't had time to react. You can't change things here until light could have reached that spot, and light hasn't reached that spot yet.
So would it be anything like when, say, you're on the frame of the pole, and then it hits that reinforced wall, the shed would technically stop moving? So would it
then? Well, so my shed is rigid. It's attached to the earth. It's going to be. I made this really strong so that it's going to be exactly the way it always is.
So Pat's saying if you were like riding on the front of the pole, as soon as you hit that wall, the shed stops moving.
Well, so it's most convenient not to ride the front of the wall, front of the pole vault, because then you're not going to be able to report what happened. So if you're in a train that's running alongside at exactly the same speed as the pole vault, that's what you're going to see. Here at the end, the rear end of this pole hasn't had time to react. It's still following the train because light can't have propagated from this original collision to tell this guy to do anything different. Okay, so you use the word rigid, and I think I already told you that there is no such thing that's rigid. That when I push this end doesn't respond instantaneously. The speed of sound needs to propagate through this material before this thing can actually move. I don't know about accordion with respect to space and time, but it's going to accordion with respect to itself, right? So it's going to end up crumpled, and this crumpling, the information that the crumpling is occurring is going to be propagating out, but just in front of the actual crumpling event, and it never propagates out far enough to stop this end before it reaches the far side of this shed. Say again?
So explodes almost.
I'm not sure I like the word explode. So we all agree that the pole vault is going to be totally crumpled inside the shed. That has to be the result if I don't open the door. So I don't know. Let's view the same thing from this Minkowski sort of point of view. So here is the world line that is the left-hand side of the rod moving at some speed, and here's the right-hand world line of the rod moving at some speed. And these things you can see in the rest frame. This distance you remember is 1, but this thing is shorter. So we can close the door at t equals 0 and have that rod totally inside a space that is smaller than the rod is. But that's not what it looks like according to the rod. Remember that the uniform times correspond to one of these kind of horizontal lines. So what we see here is this door closed at some negative t prime, at some earlier time, and then you closed this door. If we actually made a measurement at the same time, we'd see that it's this long. But we're not playing fair with our definition of at the same time. So, and I'm not sure if we can see about this crashing event too. If this end of the rod is going to be affected, the speed of light is going to be traveling like that, right? And one of these diagonals. So it can't be affected at all until that position has occurred. This position here, right? Because light is traveling along these 45 degree lines, so the event of the crash of the unopened door, it will be traveling like that. So the first instant that this side could be affected is there. And that's well after I closed the door. Yep, it is weird. I agree. More questions? So you haven't succeeded in avoiding new material yet.
I haven't. Can we pull up the diagram?
So. What we were talking about last time is how to make vectors. And the reason we want to make vectors is it's the only way we can guarantee that the equations of physics are going to be the same in an airplane as opposed to on the ground. Right, so that just as rotations don't change the equations of physics, right? F vector equals ma vector, and so it doesn't matter whether we're in a rotated system or a non-rotated system. If our equations of physics, like Maxwell's equations, are the same in moving and non-moving coordinate systems, then we're satisfying Galilean invariance. So we want to make vectors. And we've got a list of ways that we can make vectors from existing vectors, and the only existing vector we've got is space-time itself. So we can take derivatives, but it better be a derivative with respect to an invariant, otherwise it's not going to be a vector anymore. And the convenient invariant to use is what's called the proper time. It's the space-time separation distance between the two spots where you're measuring the value of x. We can take the gradient of things, right? Here's what the gradient is. That'll make a vector. We can contract things. That'll eliminate some vector indices, but if we started with lots, we could have a vector when we're done. And we can juxtapose vectors, kind of like this. Literally, a cross product is out. It's a special property of three-dimensional space that particular combination makes something that transforms right. But we can at least juxtapose vectors kind of like that to make an anti-symmetric matrix that looks a lot like a cross product. Okay, so we've had these kind of combinations of four things for a while. So here we have the vector potential and voltage, and here we have the electrical current and the electrical charge density. And if we put them together with these I's, we make things that actually are nice vectors. And if we take this anti-symmetric combination of derivatives and a vector, you can just do the calculation. What we're getting is automatically these B fields. So technically, in the four-dimensional sense, the electric field and the magnetic field are not vectors. They don't transform the way R transforms. And we'll see that when we talk about the electric and magnetic fields of a uniformly charged particle. They don't just point away in kind of the natural sense. They are parts of this 4x4 matrix that is the field tensor. And then it turns out we can write Maxwell's equations in this covariant form, where everything's a vector. And this one equation contains these two equations. And the other two Maxwell's equations are actually automatically satisfied just by writing the F as this antisymmetric combination of the A vectors. So if we want to figure out what F looks like in transform frames, this is what we need to do. We need to use the Lorentz transformation on the first coordinate and use the Lorentz transformation on the second coordinate, and we end up getting out what the E and B fields are from the result. Okay, and that's a homework problem. You're supposed to do that process and show that these are the relationships you get when you transform these quantities. Okay, so it's a more complicated setup. There are betas and gammas around, but it's a different and maybe slightly more complicated setup than what we had for the coordinates. And it's again because the electric and magnetic fields are part of this antisymmetric tensor. So we then went on to talk about what the electric and magnetic fields look like for a high-speed moving particle. And I'm sure you've had this experience when you're listening to a jet that's flying overhead, and the sound seems to be coming from there, but the plane is actually there. And that's, of course, because the sound was emitted there, and it took some time for it to reach you. And if you think about it, that's exactly how it should work for this electric field, right? It depends on the retarded position. And so you would think that the electric field would point at where the particle was when that electric field was emitted, not the current position of the particle. But it turns out there's kind of some magic that occurs, and in fact, the electric field does point back to the instantaneous, according to us, location of the particle. Since the moving charge corresponds to a current, if we apply a right-hand rule, we come to the conclusion that the magnetic field should be rotating around kind of like that. And I don't know, kind of automatically we think that the magnetic field should be small if we're distant from the moving charge. What's kind of surprising is that the electric field isn't as azimuthally symmetric anymore. The electric field is concentrated in kind of a pancake that is perpendicular to the velocity vector. So the electric field would be big here, big any place in a circle that's surrounding it. And it's about gamma times stronger. So if we're talking about, as we can make, gammas of 1,000 or so, we can have electric fields way stronger in this perpendicular direction than they would be normally. The pancake doesn't extend very far. It's roughly an angle that's 1 over gamma. So this very narrow range of strong electric field is also pretty narrowly confined. And if you think about what this looks like here, it looks a whole lot like light. That is to say, we have an electric field that's going that way. We have a B field that's out of the board. If we do right-hand rule, E cross B, the light should be moving this way, and that's just the way the electric and magnetic fields are moving for this moving particle. Yes? So, threshold?
Is there something, I mean, it works for like a 10 ring hole. Is there some sort of cutoff for how long hole?
You're saying, would this stop working at some point?
Yeah.
So, the amount of Lorentz contraction that we get, that is to say, how small this thing goes, it depends on the rest length of the rod divided by gamma. So there's no limit to gamma. So I can take a light year long rod, and if I get a gamma that is, you know, a zillion billion, I can make that light year rod, you know, still fit in the palm of my hand. But if I don't have unlimited gamma available to me, then I only get so much length contraction, right? So maybe I can split things in half because gamma is 2, but then if I take twice as big a rod, it's not going to fit in the container. Okay, so the amount of shrinking is proportional to the original length, and it depends on gamma. More questions? Well, I think we now have exhausted all of our available time. It ain't over till the fat lady sings, as they say. So what we said, 7 at 7 o'clock on study day.
7 or 7:30. And then he said, you should really review the test before you come because you all have it.
It's like Christmas. You want to open it with absolutely no idea what's in the package, don't you?
No.
Makes it more exciting.
Well, we're old now. We don't
always,
like Christmas.
Yeah, we always know, kind of.
Yeah, you've always had an idea, especially when you're older, you know, like, no surprise. And because you just see them buy it. That's how it
is.
So awful.
Baking supplies.
Red
tins.
I guess I'm done.
See you later, Margaret. Send me a picture.
Good.
This is probably as good a spot as any for that. And this is empty. I can throw this out. Oh, I didn't turn off my chopper.